Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The U.S. Supreme Court and partisan politics. Hello again, I'm Norman Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Judge Sonia Sotomayor is likely to be the next member of the U.S. Supreme Court, but her confirmation hearings provide a political platform for both parties. We'll hear about the first day of what could be a week of setting agendas. Also on Which Way L.A., today's the 50th anniversary of a potentially deadly event near Los Angeles that few people know about. The partial meltdown of a nuclear reactor. We'll hear what happened then and why it could still be significant now. First, here's the news. Norman Alney back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. Since the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island in 1979, the U.S. has not ordered another nuclear power plant. But the drive to stop global warming has created new interest in power sources that don't emit greenhouse gases. What can be learned from L.A.'s own nuclear meltdown, a little-known event that occurred exactly 50 years ago today? We'll find out at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point, the first day of Judge Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation hearings for the U.S. Supreme Court got underway with Democratic Chairman Patrick Leahy.
She brings a wealth and diversity of experience to the court. I hope all Americans are encouraged by Judge Sotomayor's achievements and by her nomination to the nation's highest court. Hers is a success story in which all Americans can take pride.
Jeff Sessions of Alabama spoke first for the Republicans, making reference to President Obama's famous remark that he wants a justice with empathy.
I will not vote for, and no senator should vote for, an individual nominated by any president who believes it is acceptable for a judge to allow their personal background, gender, prejudices, or sympathies to sway their decision in favor of or against parties in, before the court.
Again, Jeff Sessions of Alabama and Patrick Leahy of Vermont starting things off today. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor and a legal correspondent at Slate.com. And Dahlia, it's always good to talk with you.
Hi there, Warren.
Based on what happened today, how do you think it's going to go for the rest of the week?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What you're really seeing is a war of words and a war of ideas that has virtually nothing to do with Judge Sotomayor. And in fact, one of the things that's really interesting is watching certainly the Republicans on the committee talking about how her record is even immaterial, this massive 17-year judicial record. What really matters is what's in her heart. What really matters is some of the speeches she's made. So it's very, very interesting. You sort of have this sense that they're literally wallpapering over the person who's sitting in the room so they can talk about judicial activism, or the Democrats can talk about judicial empathy, and that she's just sort of there as like a nice plant that they're talking about, but this really has nothing ultimately to do with her or her record or who she is.
With regard to the Roberts Court, he, of course, the Chief Justice now, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, did say that she was concerned that so many people who came before the committee gave misleading answers. She appeared to be referring to Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito as well, and gave the impression that she didn't think they were straight.
That's been a big theme today. I mean, certainly Feinstein said it about Roberts and Alito promising that super cases were super duper precedent and they would never be violated, and then turning around and violating them. But, you know, I think we're hearing the same thing from Republicans on the committee who say, you know, sure, Ruth Bader Ginsburg looked like a moderate mainstream judge, but then look at, she went bananas when she got on the bench. So I think one of the real themes we're seeing today, and we hear it over and over again, is you can't tell from who this person is or what they say what they're going to become when they're really untethered from precedent and from a court of appeals that's higher. And so then there's this sense of terrific anxiety on the part of the Republicans that essentially goes, why should we believe you?
And those Republican senators, actually all members of the committee, of course, are going to get 30 minutes each to grill her along these lines. Back to Dahlia Lithwick.
That's right. I mean, they're going to have a lot of time with her. And part of this grilling is, again, an opportunity for each senator to talk about their pet projects and their pet issues. But I think part of it is, you know, she has a huge judicial record. And so some of the senators have already telegraphed areas of their anxiety. She's going to get a lot of questions about gun rights. She's going to get a lot of questions about criminal prosecution. She's going to get questions about the war on terror, an area that she actually hasn't ruled on very much. A lot of questions about abortion. So I think one of the things, again, that you're going to see in these question periods is you're going to get a sense of a lot more about what's making the senator, him or herself, anxious, rather than a real attempt to ferret out answers from Sotomayor, who probably will be as good as her predecessors at not really answering.
We're going to hear a lot about discrimination and affirmative action, too, with regard to the Ritchie case in New Haven. We're speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, the senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. One of the other things that this had to do, or one of the other people that all this had to do with, was President Obama. Here's what he had to say in explanation of asking for that term or asking for that quality of what he referred to as empathy from a Supreme Court justice. He made this comment in a television interview. You'll hear the interviewer, too.
I want somebody who has the intellectual firepower, but also a little bit of a common touch and has a practical sense of how the world works.
And that's what empathy is?
Well, that's what empathy is to me. And I think that that's those criteria of common sense, practicality, a sense of you know, what ordinary Americans are going through every day.
And here's how Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, parsed the idea of empathy.
And I fear that this empathy standard is another step down the road to a liberal, activist, results-oriented, relativistic world where laws lose their fixed meaning, unelected judges set policy. Americans are seen as members of separate groups rather than as simply Americans, where the constitutional limits on government power are ignored when politicians want to buy out private companies.
Dahlia Lithwick, back to you, senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com. Is that pretty unusually strong language for a confirmation hearing like this?
Oh, no. I mean, I think this language of judicial activism, unelected judges, elitist unelected judges legislating from the bench, this is actually pretty boilerplate. I've been surprised at how well, actually, the Senate Republicans have used the word empathy, which is a completely new word. I mean, Obama really introduced it when he was stumping. We hadn't talked about judicial empathy 4 years ago during the Alito and Roberts nomination, and yet empathy has already been sort of wonderfully folded into the boilerplate conversation so that you can see that empathy has become a code word for judicial activists, unelected judges legislating for the bench. So I think it's just, you know, whether or not empathy is moving the ball forward or backward or sideways in terms of talking about judges, I think Obama is trying to say something that isn't quite what Senator said. I don't think empathy is supposed to mean you only feel biased toward one side, but I think that I think Republicans today have done a pretty good job of appropriating that word empathy to suggest that that is Sotomayor's core problem. She only feels biased towards certain groups or individuals, and that's going to cloud her judgment. And I think she's going to have to answer to that in her statement today, whether she talks about empathy or not. I think she needs to do a really good job of saying, hey, I don't have a thumb on the scale for anybody.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com, speaking to us from Capitol Hill. And thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
Philip Howard is author of Life Without Lawyers and the best-selling The Death of Common Sense. He's a partner in the law firm Covington & Burling. Philip Howard, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you, Warren.
We're getting a lesson here in the development of political language right before our eyes.
Yeah.
So what's your take on what's happened so far and on the nomination itself, and do you think it's going to go through?
Well, first, I agree with almost everything Dahlia just said. This is all about the senators. It's not about Judge Sotomayor, who, by all accounts, is not only highly qualified, but based on her judicial opinions, really quite moderate. So I can't discern from her opinions, you know, where her soul ultimately is or how she's going to decide on some controversial decision coming down the pike, but to me, she's clearly qualified, and she's clearly going to be confirmed. And this week is mainly about the political theater of arguing about the role of the court.
Interesting that some of the senators conceded that she was going to be confirmed, some of the Republicans included, including the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, who made the point that he worked as hard as anybody for John McCain, but John McCain lost. Here's what he concluded from that.
My inclination is that elections matter, and I'm not going to be upset with any of my colleagues who find that you're a bridge too far, because in many ways what you've done in your legal career and the speeches you've made give me great insight as to where you'll come out on these 5% of cases. But President Obama won the election, and I will respect that.
That 5% of the cases was what his estimate was of cases that really would make a difference and had the potential for changing the law and reinterpreting the Constitution. But Philip Howard, the Republicans also said that these speeches that she has made are important, because once you get to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's not like being an appellate court judge, which is what she has been. But in the case of the Supreme Court, you don't have anybody looking over your shoulder. Nobody can reverse you if they don't like the way you ruled.
That's true, but again, you have to look at what someone does and not what they say. Often what people say is a product of the times in which they're saying it. I think her talk about the wise Latina, you know, by being, you know, being better is a, I do think that's a sour note. And I think that I actually like the discussion about empathy, because maybe it will prompt a more coherent discussion about the role of courts, which isn't to, you know, go for the victim, and nor is it to go for the corporation. It's to, you know, create a framework. But the Republican, you know, when Senator Sessions says laws have a fixed meaning, well, that's just baloney, you know.
You know, it is. A lot of people think they do.
Well, but they don't. I mean, that's the reason it's in a court, because reasonable people can disagree about the application of this constitutional principle or this statute or what's reasonable in the circumstances. And, you know, the hard job of courts is to draw or try to maintain these boundaries of what's legally actionable and what the state can do and what it can't do. And I think having a discussion about whether the role is actually to help every person who's injured versus maintaining this framework is a useful discussion to have. And I hope, if nothing else, these hearings kind of somehow elucidate or at least help create a better understanding of the role of courts.
Philip Howard with Covington and Burling, author of Life Without Lawyers and The Death of Common Sense. Manuel Miranda is a former aide to Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, counsel to the former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, now chair of the Third Branch Conference. That's a coalition working to influence nominations to the federal court. And Manuel Miranda, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on again.
What's your take about what we've seen today and what it means? Is this really all about the senators and not about Judge Sotomayor at all?
Well, it is about the historical process in the Senate, and we have seen some new developments. And Dahlia, I think, captured some of them quite well. The introduction of the word empathy, which, of course, the president did for us. The president introduced the word empathy and really changed the standard that has been applicable in the nomination process by presidents since George Washington. George Washington instead used the word that he would nominate. He would nominate people of high character who showed judicial temperament and judiciousness. And judiciousness means that the ability to make decisions without regard to personal interest, personal politics, personal preference, or background. And now we have a president who tells us that he is going to name somebody on the basis of empathy. And what Republicans are saying is that what that means is, well, and actually Jeff Sessions said it best. He said that empathy for one party is prejudice for another party. And so empathy isn't just what politically I think the president meant, which is that as a human being, they are sympathetic, they are empathetic, they are, you know, they're human. I think that's what politically the president meant. But in the judicial context, it suggests bias. And then when you unfortunately, if it had been any other nominee, But in the case of Judge Sotomayor, unfortunately, she has this background of saying this comment about a wise Latino woman coming to a better judgment than a white man, or perhaps even a black man. You know, how far does one go? And then, of course, the Ritchie case.
Here's California's Senator Dianne Feinstein remarking she thinks judges do bring their own experiences to the court when they're deciding cases.
I do not believe that Supreme Court justices are merely umpires calling balls and strikes. Rather, I believe that they make the decisions of individuals who bring to the court their own experiences and philosophies. Judge Sotomayor, I believe you are a warm and intelligent woman. I believe you are well studied and experienced in the law, with some 17 years of federal court experience.
Senator Feinstein from California. Again, Manuel Miranda, back to you, saying that everybody brings to the court their own experiences and philosophies. Isn't what the president and presumably Judge Sotomayor meant to say?
Well, I think that is what they meant to say. What we're seeing is a beautiful contrast, really, of right brain, left brain. Well, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. And the umpire, the rational umpire, the objective umpire, and the subjective, empathetic, wise Latina woman basing her judgments on her experience. This is a wonderful contrast for the American people to see, and I hope it continues to play out this way.
Manuel Miranda, again, now chair of the Third Branch Conference, Coalition Working to Influence Nominations to the Federal Court, former advisor to Republican politicians. Daphne Aviatar is a lawyer and journalist, a legal reporter for the Washington Independent. That's a web paper on politics and public policy published by the Center for Independent Media. And Daphne Aviatar, good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me, Warren.
What's your take on what we are seeing today? Do you think that, as the Republicans are suggesting, Judge Sotomayor is a person who's likely to take the court in a leftward liberal direction?
You know, I don't think so at all. I kind of think that is being that's something that's being used by Republicans to whip up a lot of fear and to impress their constituents. And I think that that's really actually quite unfair. And to suggest that a Supreme Court justice is not bound by law or bound by precedent is really kind of silly. I mean, of course they are. They have a bit more freedom than the Court of Appeals does. But courts of appeals decide matters of first impression all the time. And within a judge's opinion on the Court of Appeals, you see their reasoning. You see the way they approach the law, the way they approach the facts. And I think that looking at Judge Sotomayor's legal opinions on the court, both as a district court judge and as a court of appeals judge, tells you much more about how she'd be, even as a Supreme Court justice, than statements that she made 10 years ago speaking to law students who asked her to talk about, you know, the impact of being a Latina woman. I think that really, if what we're trying to have is an honest debate, you have to look at the context of all of the statements that were made. And I think that what the Republicans are trying to do in this situation is take little, you know, the wise Latina comment, things like that, completely out of context and suggest that this is really the core of who Sotomayor is. This is what's in her heart. She wants to impose Latina rule or impose empathy for Latinas as opposed to for human beings. And I think that actually I'm not as optimistic as some of your prior guests who suggested that this is going to be a very educational process and in this debate. I think actually what we're seeing is a lot of posturing for constituents, particularly among the more conservative white male Republicans whose constituents might be afraid of seeing a Latina woman on the court and what that symbolizes to them.
What about the wise Latina comment, though? Several of the senators today pointed to the fact that she said it more than once, that a wise Latina, she thought, would make a better decision than a white judge. I think that's an appropriate way of summarizing it. If she said it that many times and didn't really alter the way in which she said it, why do you have to go to the context?
Despite the context, she needs to explain what she meant by it and why she said it. And I do think that sometimes identity politics people can get carried away, and in certain settings, people are kind of pushed into talking about identity maybe more than is wise. And that was not a very wise comment. And I think she's going to have to address that.
Daphne Abiatar, once again, with the Center for Independent Media. Back to Manuel Miranda. What about this contention that we just heard, that a lot of these senators are trying to make an impression on their constituents? A bunch of them are up for re-election.
Well, look, that is ultimately the only thing they can't do. They're not going to be able to reject this nominee, unless something explosive happens. They're not going to filibuster, and they don't really even want to. So the only thing that you can do here is use this nomination process as an opportunity to speak to the people who are the ultimate stewards of the federal judiciary when they vote for a president and when they vote for senators. And I think that both sides think they've got a winning issue. That's always been the case here. Neither side seems to give it a lot of time, but Senate time. But with regard to a Supreme Court justice, you can't avoid giving it time. And so Republicans are certainly telling the American people, remember when you voted in November? Well, here's the consequence of an election. A president who promised us a post-racial world and has given us a nominee who represents perhaps the most controversial single issue in this country's history, beginning from slavery and ending with racial quotas and bias.
How would you describe that most consequential issue? Define that, if you will.
Well, the consequential issue is that this country has always been divided politically by the issue of race, beginning with slavery and then going to civil rights. And now we're divided again on issues of racial quotas and racial preference. And the Attorney General tells us that we've been cowards in the way that we have not failed to discuss the race issues. So a lot of Americans thought that this was a post-racial president and were comfortable voting for a post-racial African-American president. And now he nominates a nominee who, by her record, by her own comments, by the way, the wise Latina woman comment was made 8 times, once in a law review article that was presumably reviewed and edited and so on. So she basically is telling us what we have heard on college campuses for the last 30 to 40 years in a rather loud and shrill way, which is that there is no objective truth, that all things are relative, and that truth is to be discerned by each of us, whether along the lines of our race, our experience. There's a black truth and a Hispanic truth and so on and so on. I personally reject that. And
let me go back to Daphne Abiatar on this one. Do you think that that's what Sotomayor is saying and what the president's saying?
No. I mean, I think that there's an implication here that because the president nominated a Latino woman, that therefore he's not somehow post-racial, that if he nominated a white person, then there would be no race because that person wouldn't have a race. And there's sort of an implication that because you have someone who's a member of a minority race in this country, it therefore unfairly injects race into this issue of the Supreme Court. And I think that's sort of silly. That's not a fair characterization. And I think that I do think, however, that there has been this whole discussion, which has been rather interesting, about is there an objective interpretation of the law? And there's been a lot of Republican statements about, I want to see an objective application of the law, and Sotomayor seems to suggest that law is subjective. And yet, of course, we have a court, and we have 9 justices on the court, because obviously the law isn't always perfectly predictable, and it's not predictably applied, and there are many, many gray areas in the law, and it has to be applied based on judgment and on interpretation. And so the suggestion that I think a lot of Republicans are making at this hearing, that you don't need interpretation, that the law is just a black and white thing that can be applied, again, it doesn't make sense in the context of, we have a court to decide these gray areas, and we have 9 justices because we know that they're going to have different opinions, as wise or as intelligent as they may be. Even when they were all white, 9 white men, they had different opinions, and they would disagree, and that's because there's a lot of room for interpretation in the law, and I think that's all that Judge Sotomayor has been talking about in making these comments.
Daphne Abiatar with the Center for Independent Media. Back to Philip Howard, author of Life Without Lawyers and the Death of Common Sense. You said earlier that the law doesn't ever mean just one thing, that it's always open to interpretation. Do you think that the president was to some extent boxed in by the fact that there's never been a Latino or a Latina on the U.S. Supreme Court? Is that one of the reasons he chose Judge Sotomayor?
Of course it was. But And I don't think that's such a bad thing. Having diversity increases the credibility of our governing institutions. That isn't to say he should appoint someone who's unqualified, but no one's saying that she is unqualified, I don't think. So of course he did it that way. There are plenty of, there's a universe of incredibly well-qualified people with, who are perfectly non-diverse, and he chose one who was diverse.
Let me talk to or ask Manuel Miranda about that. You, as I understand it, are of Cuban descent. What do you think about the importance of having somebody Hispanic on the court for the first time in the history of the country?
Well, the Supreme Court is not a representative body, but it is an aspirational body. And so I agree that it is a very significant thing. It's a wonderful thing. President Bush wanted to do it. He had intended, by all accounts, to elevate Miguel Estrada. And I fought hard for him. On the other hand, I fought against Alberto Gonzalez as a potential nominee to the Supreme Court. So I'm not taken by the notion that she and I both like rice and beans and grew up on mango shakes. I mean, that's not the reason to elevate somebody to the Supreme Court, but I recognize that the Supreme Court is an aspirational body, and so it'll be a great thing to have a Hispanic, a woman Hispanic, who can be an inspiration to Latino Hispanic children all over the country. That's a wonderful thing.
Manuel Miranda, once again, with the Third Branch Conference. Quick question for Daphne Villatar. What about Judge Sotomayor as a legal scholar as compared, say, to the most conservative of the justices, particularly Anton Scalia?
They obviously have a very different style. I think that Judge Sotomayor is actually much more tempered. Scalia obviously has very strong opinions, and he makes those clear in his opinions. And if you've read Judge Sotomayor's opinions, they're very quiet. They're very careful. They're very to the letter of the law. And that's the other thing that I find a little bit surprising about this debate, and what makes me think it is more about her race and the statements that she's made and speeches about race and ethnicity, and not about her role as a judge, because when you read her opinions, they're so careful. They're almost too careful. I mean, if anyone's expecting a really liberal judge who's going to make new law or going to set new precedents in some progressive or liberal direction, they're going to be sorely disappointed. Because if you read her decisions, even in discrimination cases, for example, she's not particularly sympathetic to plaintiffs. And I think there were statistics cited at the hearing this morning, something like 83% of cases regarding race, she voted against the plaintiff. She's really not out there making big pronouncements, making big scholarly pronouncements. So I don't think she's going to be a great intellectual force on the court. I think she seems to be a very careful, solid judge, but I don't see her trying to be like Justice Scalia to push the court ideologically in any particular direction.
All right. Well, that's as much time as we have for the moment. Thank you all very much. Daphne Villatar, the Center for Independent Media, Manuel Miranda with the Third Branch Conference, Philip Howard, his books, The Death of Common Sense and Life Without Lawyers, and our earlier guest, Dahlia Lithwick with Slate.com. Good to have all of you with us today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, an anniversary of the nuclear meltdown near Los Angeles 50 years ago today on Which Way LA. Warman Alney back with Which Way LA. It's been 50 years since America's first nuclear meltdown in the Santa Susana Mountains between the San Fernando and Simi Valleys. The site was a massive research installation which tested 30,000 rocket engines over the years and included 10 nuclear reactors. On July 13, 1959, one of those, called the Sodium Reactor Experiment, sprung a leak. It was shut down. But before the problem had been resolved, the reactor was started up again. It ran for nearly 2 weeks without any kind of containment, like the big concrete domes that shield commercial reactors at San Onofre and other nuclear power plants. Radioactive gas was vented into the air. How much? To this day, nobody knows. And cleanup operations are still going on. John Pace was a trainee just 20 years old at the time. He was asked to keep radiation out of the control room. John Pace, welcome to our program.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be with you.
What were the people you were working for most concerned about at that point?
It was concerned about what had happened after the meltdown of the reactor. When I came to work that morning, real early morning, they was worried about their families being and others being exposed to the radiation that was released from the reactor a number of hours before I came to work.
Now, at that point, they didn't even know it was a meltdown, did they?
No, they didn't call it a meltdown. They called it a power excursion at that time.
What happened? What did you do?
Well, when I came to work, I noticed supervisors that was there and people that was of a great amount of excitement, so I guess what the right word for it. I knew something was different than, from when I normally would come to work. So I listened to what was going on. As being a trainee, I didn't have the knowledge of everything because I just got arrived to work. So they had talked about how they had a power excursion on the shift just before the mine, and how the radiation, they had to release the radiation from the reactor with all of a sudden. They couldn't contain it, or it was just everything happened too quickly. And they that worry was on their mind.
Now, they asked you, as I understand it, to clean up the some portion of the premises. What did that mean?
Well, when they clean up the premises, the whole high bay areas. That's the area that they have the reactor was in, called the high bay area. It got very contaminated from the meltdown. So they asked me to help on the cleanup of cleaning up the radiation and contamination that was in that area.
Did they help you keep track of the amount of radiation that you were exposed to?
At first, they watched those things, how much radiation that I was exposed to, yes.
And what happened later?
Later, they decided to... The radiation was high enough that they did not keep track of it. We worked without having our film badges on, so we wouldn't be overdosed with the amount of radiation that we heard there.
So not that you wouldn't be overdosed, but that nobody would know how much you'd been overdosed.
Okay, there you go. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Have you suffered any ill effects, or has anybody else that you know?
I have suffered some ill effects with my lungs, and that was my key problem I have with my health, was my lungs.
And are you sure that's due to the exposure that you suffered?
Yes, because the chemicals I used for cleanup, I used some pretty harsh chemicals for the cleanup. Soap and water wasn't something you could use in the cleanup.
So it was the cleanup chemicals rather than the radiation, you think, that caused you the trouble?
No, it was both, but that was a large part of the cleanup chemicals.
Okay, John Pace, trainee worker at the sodium reactor experiment when the meltdown occurred exactly 50 years ago today. The U.S. has not built a nuclear power plant since the Three Mile Island meltdown in 1979, but global warming has created new interest in an alternative energy source that does not produce greenhouse gases. Dan Hirsch is president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap. That's a Los Angeles nuclear watchdog group. He's also a lecturer in nuclear policy at UC Santa Cruz. Dan Hirsch, good to talk with you.
I'm here.
What can we learn from this incident that occurred 50 years ago today?
Well, a very serious nuclear accident can occur in a period of just minutes, and it can take decades and decades to have to clean up afterwards. We're half a century after the meltdown occurred, and yet the cleanup is still at least a decade away from being completed. They've already spent over a quarter of $1 billion of taxpayer money to clean up radioactive contamination at this site. Not all of it's from the meltdown. There were three other reactors that had accidents at this facility and lots of other spills. And we've now allocated an additional $40 million of stimulus funds just to do a radiation survey to find all the contamination. But these are extraordinarily dangerous devices, and they can, in an instant, go bad and end up releasing significant amounts of radioactivity. The other thing that we can learn, I believe, is that there's a tremendous push right now for new reactors, in part based on a kind of hoped-for nuclear amnesia, which is the proponents are hoping that the public will forget the fiascos that occurred the last time we pushed very hard for nuclear power. And so incidents like the SRE meltdown, this meltdown in Los Angeles, if those can be kept secret, if they can be forgotten, it becomes much easier to try to start all over again. And in particular, the proponents have been pushing for a new type of reactor that relies primarily on sodium as a coolant, which is what was used at the SRE. These new reactors that they're talking about would breed more plutonium than they consume. And sodium-cooled reactors are extremely dangerous, as we saw with this sodium reactor experiment.
Have you or anybody else been able to document that anybody was hurt, that their health effects were, in fact, a consequence of what happened at the SRE, the sodium reactor experiment?
A study was done by the UCLA School of Public Health, funded by the Department of Energy, examining the nuclear workers at the site. And we can't segregate what portion of their injury was due to the meltdown versus what was due to these other three accidents or other exposures. But the exposures at the facility were found by the UCLA team to have resulted in significantly increased cancer death rates for cancers of the lung, the lymph system, and the blood system. The most exposed radiation workers had tripled the cancer death rates as the lesser exposed.
So there has then been a significant finding. How many workers were there at the plant?
I don't know the full number, but certainly there were thousands over the period in which this facility was operating as a nuclear facility, I believe in the tens of thousands total.
Okay, Dan Hirsch again with Bridge the Gap, a nuclear policy lecturer at UC Santa Cruz. France depends on nuclear power for 75% of its electricity. The founder and president of Environmentalists for Nuclear Energy, EFN, is an international nonprofit advocacy organization based outside Paris. I should say that's the group. The founder is Bruno Combi. He's also the author of several books, including Environmentalists for Nuclear Energy. He and most of the board members of his organization are nuclear physicists. They say, however, the organization does not take money from the nuclear industry. Bruno Combi, welcome to you.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
What conclusions do you draw from what happened 50 years ago here in Los Angeles? Do you agree with Dan Hirsch that it was a cautionary situation at best?
I totally disagree with Don Hirsch is that our philosophy is quite different. He seems to be afraid of everything, and we are optimists. And when you look at the history of nuclear power, the worst accident in the history of nuclear power in the U.S. is Three Mile Island accident, and this led to no one being injured and no one being killed. Well, when the worst accident in an industry leads to no one being injured, it means it's a very safe industry. We believe that nuclear power is the safest, the cleanest, and the only energy available on Earth that is able to bridge the gap. I must say that I love the name of your organization, Dan, Bridge the Gap. It's very good. The only problem seems to be that you're standing on the wrong bridge and looking in the wrong direction. Nuclear power is like a lifeline. It's the only solution that we have at hand to go out of oil, move out of oil. What will we do when we don't have any oil anymore? The only solution that is available, and it really bridges the gap, is nuclear power. So we really need it. Otherwise, I'm afraid our civilization will not survive, as you fear.
Dan Hirsch, back to you. Mr. Combi says nobody was killed at Three Mile Island, the worst nuclear accident in the country. How do you respond to that?
Well, the study by Professor Stephen Wing of TMI indicated significant casualties. But the important point is that Chernobyl is clearly the worst nuclear accident in history, which he leaves out. And the estimates are clear in the tens of thousands for that. One must remember that nuclear power has a whole series of problems, the potential for meltdowns and losing a whole state in terms of casualties. But in addition, it proliferates nuclear weapons, it produces waste that has to be isolated for the human environment for tens of thousands of generations. And what I'm most concerned about is when one says it's the only solution, and when it keeps out of that formula the marvelous, safe, and renewable technologies that come from sun, wind, and so forth, I think it creates an absolutely false debate. I really do believe that you can only be for nuclear power if you have a short memory. And I think the SRE is that kind of wake-up call that reminds us that this is a very dangerous technology and that things can go wrong very, very quickly.
Bruno Combi, what about Chernobyl? Tens of thousands of casualties from that.
we could discuss about the tens of thousands of casualties, because that's not what the official figures are and the real studies show. But in any case, what you can see about Chernobyl is that it was a reactor without a containment. Every reactor in the Western world today does have a containment, in fact, a triple barrier between the nuclear fuel and the environment. You have the cladding of the fuel, then you have the reactor core, which was not damaged, even in the case of the SRE experimental reactor, which was a small 20-megawatt sodium-cooled and graphite-moderated reactor.
Excuse me, but the core of the reactor was damaged, and the fuel rods were broken. Film showed
the
showed them.
You are right. The fuel rods were molten, but the core of the reactor was still under pressure, so it was not that damaged. The fuel rods were damaged, not the core of the reactor itself. So you have to be right about what happened exactly and not invent untrue stories, please.
Okay, Dan Hirsch, back to you. Well, what about this issue of containment? We have that now at all the reactors, as everybody knows, who drives by San Onofre.
Well, first of all, just to correct one thing, as you point out, Warren, a third of the fuel melted, and that is what you were concerned about in a reactor accident. When the fuel melts, the radioactivity gets released. The comment about Chernobyl not having containment is simply an error. NRC Commissioner James Asselstein disclosed at the time of the accident that Chernobyl had partial containment built to the same design criteria as ours were. I served on an NRC panel at the time, and our containment structures in the United States are not designed to withstand the kind of pressure that can occur in a nuclear accident. So I think the fundamental problem is this. You can usually tell whether an industry has confidence in the things it's saying by how it behaves. The industry tells the public that nuclear power is completely safe and very cheap. It's currently telling the Congress that it's so expensive they will not build another one unless they can get $50 billion of taxpayer loan guarantees. It can't compete in the economy without that huge taxpayer subsidy. And they have repeatedly said that the technology is so dangerous they would never build a nuclear reactor unless they can get indemnified from the costs of an accident. So on the one hand, they say it's so safe there can't be an accident. On the other hand, they tell the Congress it's so dangerous they can't build any unless they're indemnified from the consequences of an accident.
Dan Hirsch again with the nuclear watchdog group Bridge the Gap. Matt Wald is a reporter for the New York Times. He's covered nuclear issues since 1979, the year that Three Mile Island melted down. And Matt Wald, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Good. It would appear that reasonable people can disagree on very important issues.
Well, I'd like to go back and disaggregate some of the things said before. The first is that no reactors were built after Three Mile Island. In fact, about 20 were finished after Three Mile Island.
No one has been ordered. I guess that's way to say it.
The last one ordered that wasn't canceled was in 1974.
Okay.
But a key point is that the ones that people want to order now are not sodium reactors the way that the Santa Susana reactor was. There's some discussion of whether to revive sodium technology, but that's not the issue before us right now. The other point is I listen to a lot of state regulators, utility executives, and others, and it's not accident risk that drives the debate right now. The companies have determined that the chance of accident that wrecks their asset, that converts, say, a billion-dollar asset into a billion-dollar liability, which is what they did at Three Mile Island in about an hour and a half, that the chance of such an accident is so small that it's not really a business concern. And no company would want to go through that to put in all the effort and money to build a reactor and then have it destroy itself. It's like taking your new car out and totaling it. The real risk in nuclear power right now is something different. It's that you build a plant, it costs you a lot of money, and by the time it's ready to come to market, the electricity market is soft, the price of electricity is low, the price of competing technologies is low, and you lose your shirt. That's really what the companies are worried about.
So it's not so cheap then?
Well, nobody is exactly sure what it would cost to build, given that we haven't finished very many in the last 30 years. And nobody is really certain, if you broke ground today, what the price of electricity will be 8 or 10 years hence. We don't know what the price of natural gas will be. We don't know what the price of a ton of carbon will be. It's really hard to estimate, and it's a rather large bet.
Dan Hirsch, back to you. You indicated earlier that there was some effort to prevent nuclear power companies from or to indemnify them from lawsuits for injuries. Does that go to this question about accident risk?
Yes, it does. I mean, that's what is known as the Price-Anderson Act, which was put in place originally in the 1950s when this was a very new technology, but has been renewed every 10 or 15 years since. And I think that Matt's argument, which is a cogent one about what is going on in the minds of many of these industry people, which is they simply are insecure about whether this ever could compete in the marketplace. I think that, however, additionally, I doubt that any of them would be building plants if they did not have that indemnification by Price-Anderson.
To what extent are they indemnified? What does that mean?
If there were a nuclear accident, the industry would only have to pay a very small part of what the total cost, the total injury to the public could be. So unlike any other technology where if you cause harm, you are liable to pay for it, if there were a nuclear accident, you would be protected from having to pay for the injuries caused, except for a small percentage.
So, Matt Wald, is that, as Mr. Hirsch suggests, the reason that the industry isn't worried about accidents?
No. I think the big problem is, from the industry's point of view, the probability of accident that causes off-site damage is pretty small. The probability of accident that causes damage at the plant itself is more a significant worry, but they rank that worry as fairly low. I should also say
But is that in part because they're indemnified from losses?
No, they're certainly not indemnified for losing their own assets. Also, the industry collectively would pay out several hundred million dollars in case of accident. The reactor at which the accident took place would pay out a smaller sum. I don't think at this time that people in that business think that it's possible to have such an accident. They may be wrong, but I don't think that they're looking at this as a realistic possibility.
Let me go back to Bruno Combe in France, where he is the president of Environmentalists for Nuclear Energy. He has taken time off from a Bastille Day party. We appreciate that very much. I just need to mention that so our listeners will know what you have given up, at least for a few moments. What about waste in France? If 75% of the power is generated by nuclear power, what happens to the waste? That's an issue we haven't resolved here in the United States. In California, there's a law against having a new nuclear power plant until the waste issue is resolved.
That's a very good question. You see, what makes nuclear power so different from the other types of fuel we have today is the factor 1 million. Just 1 gram of uranium produces as much energy as 1 ton of oil or gas. 1 gram to 1 ton is a factor 1 million. It means that the harm that we do to the planet to take the primary matter, the fuel, is a million times smaller, so there's hardly not any scar at all. Just a few uranium mines on the planet are enough to supply enough energy to replace oil that we're burning by billions of tons today. And so there's very little harm is done to the environment, and the amount of waste that is produced is in accordingly small proportions. So it's very tiny amounts. For example, for the whole of France, since 50 years, it's just the size of a football field and about 2 or 3 feet high. It's very small, and it's all contained in one building. Now, the key to this is also nuclear reprocessing. When you reprocess, the volume is really infinitely small. And it's not dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years, as Dan said a few minutes ago. It's dangerous mostly in the first years and dozens of years, and then you have to protect for another couple of centuries, but not that much, especially when it's reprocessed, because the short-lived elements are very radioactive, but they disintegrate very fast, And the long-lived elements last a long time, but they're not very radioactive, so it's not so dangerous. So you have to go into the small details, but in fact, it's the cleanest energy we have today. It's nuclear. The safest we have for the future is nuclear, and it's abundant. It's the only solution. You see, as an environmentalist, I'm in favor, of course, of energy conservation. We can do a lot more. I live in an eco house in the close suburbs of Paris. It requires 20 times less energy. All this works. But we still live in an industrial society where you need a reliable source of baseload power. And there's only one in the future that does that, and it's nuclear.
Dan Hirsch, if France can deal with its nuclear waste in the manner that Bruno Combe suggests, why can't the United States?
Because France isn't dealing with the nuclear waste. France does not have a high-level repository any more than we do. We don't. Yucca Mountain has recently been canceled. France doesn't even have a Yucca Mountain. It is simply stockpiling that material on the surface and waiting for some possible solution later on. When Mr. Combe says that the stuff is mainly short-lived and lasts only a couple hundred years, he really knows better. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. It's hazardous for 500,000 years. When he says that it is so compact that it can be on a football field, we're not concerned about its volume. No one's concerned that someone's going to drop this on somebody. We are concerned about how toxic. It's millions of times more toxic than virtually anything else. Plutonium, a millionth of an ounce, if inhaled, will cause lung cancer with a virtual 100% certainty. So France is doing nothing with its waste, just as we're doing nothing. No place on Earth has found a repository for high-level waste. And the laws of physics can't be changed. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. So what's worrying me is that there is a bit of a propaganda campaign. For example, Mr. Combi continues to refer to himself as an environmentalist, but he's a nuclear engineer. His organization is composed, his board of directors are all nuclear engineers. There's an effort to sell this, to let people think that the waste is dangerous for 200 years rather than hundreds of thousands, and to make people think that the risk of it is its volume rather than its toxicity, and to make it seem that when the nuclear engineers are organizing that they are, in fact, environmentalists, when all of the environmental groups have kept their same position about nuclear power. Look, at the end of the day...
Let me let Mr. Combi defend himself on those issues, if you will.
Yes, I would like to answer a few things. When you said that all our board members are nuclear engineers, it's absolutely untrue. In fact, there's only one that is, and it's me. The other ones are not nuclear engineers, so... Please inform yourself before you speak about other people. And now about nuclear waste, there are solutions. You can reprocess the waste or not reprocess it. You can store it in different manners. You can isolate it from the environment in different manners. And nuclear waste is not a problem. There are various solutions to this. The reason that there is no high-level waste repository in France and in the United States is that people like Dan Hirsch continuously oppose it, when it's totally stupid, because there are solutions that could very simply be put into operation.
Matt Wald, let me go back to you, our reporter with the New York Times. Excuse me, Mr. Combi, for interrupting you, but it is the waste issue that has caused such a problem here in this country. The president, Mr. Obama, has now put the kibosh on Yucca Mountain out in Nevada, the only high-level waste repository that's being considered. So it's a reality here, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I don't think that the lack of a permanent repository is going to prevent new reactors from being built. I think reactors may or may not be built, but that won't be the deciding question. The reason is, it's true we have no permanent solution for this stuff. It's also true that the volume is fairly small, and you're committing yourself to a very long-term babysitting effort. And you have to think about how serious a problem the babysitting is. And you may decide that it's worthwhile. The way the French do reprocessing does not solve the waste problem. The Bush administration had a plan for a much more thorough reprocessing called the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, but that would have required a lot of new technology and, in fact, gotten us back into sodium reactors, which is the kind that had the Santa Susana accident, although presumably we'd be better at it now than we were 50 years ago. It does pose safety challenges, and you'd have to think long and hard about whether you wanted to do that. But the waste is there. The waste is what it is. It will require isolation for a very long period. We don't like kicking our problems down the road to future generations, but it's not that extensive a problem. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is about to change its policy and say that we can store it in dry casks, these little silos made of steel and concrete, for the next 100 years or so. And that's probably what's going to happen to the stuff for as long as you and I are around.
Another interruption in the interest of time. We just have 1 minute left. Dan Hirsch, is that a redefinition of the problem as far as you're concerned?
Yes. I mean, ethically, there's a huge question about intergenerational ethics. To be able to get a bit of electricity now and to kick the problem down the can so that thousands of generations to come have to deal with the problem and the cancers, I think we really need to think about that in terms of the ethics involved.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Once again, the 50th anniversary of the meltdown in Santa Susana. Thank you all very much for being with us. Dan Hirsch, president of Bridge the Gap, also lecturer in nuclear policy at UC Santa Cruz. Matt Wald with the New York Times. Bruno Combi, thank you again for taking the time to be with us, with Environmentalists for Nuclear Energy in Paris. And our first guest, John Pace, trainee worker in Santa Susana when the meltdown occurred. Which Way LA, produced tonight by Francis Anderton and Katie Cooper, our man. managing producer Karen Ranziner, technical director Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayLA. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.